Now, without any more ado, I'd like to introduce Roy Norton, who's had a lifelong experience in television, which he's now going to share with us. His plaudits are, I think, probably legendary. Really haven't read a bit about his CV. But the thing that impresses me most, he's recently been made a fellow of Southampton Solent University, and he's sharing his knowledge with younger people, new young people coming on, just like me. Okay, Roy, over to you.
Thank you very much, Jim. Can I first of all say it's a privilege to be here, and I'm so grateful for turning up on a lovely day. You could be on the beach, couldn't you? It's very special for me because I started this in October last year, and I don't want to be disloyal to some of the branches of the U3A, but the actual facilities you've got here are amazing. And I'd like to thank the committee, Jim and Sue, for inviting me and the rest of the committee. And a special mention about John Hale. I mean, he really is a walking encyclopedia of technology, I assure you. And you're very lucky to have him, and he's helped me enormously. Incidentally, I never thought as a 13-year-old cycling down from Andover with my tent and pitching it on Lulworth Cove Hill with no restrictions that I'd ever come to this sort of incredibly impressive audience. So, you know, when you think of a 13-year-old, if somebody said you will be in a hall like this, you wouldn't have believed them. And why am I here? You'll probably ask that at the end of it. But basically, it's not a history lesson. It's not very technical. My wife changes the fuses, so I can assure you that. It's just really memories over these decades. There were several decades, a lot happened, and I just want to share the memories with you. What am I going to talk about? Well, it won't be sort of enormous sort of documentary major items, but I'll talk about the Diana Charles wedding, a day doing a programme in a lifer's prison. I've got an item about the assassination of bin Laden, which I think will interest you. I've also got one of the worst mistakes you could ever make in television, which has stayed with me for my life. And if I was to tell you now, I would have to sit down and not go on, because I'm so embarrassed by it. But I may pluck up courage at the end and to tell you. And you'll see HRH, our queen, as you've never seen her before, towards the end of the programme. So let's get started. The first days. That's me, a shade under 20, a virgin. Very different in those days. They're at it in the kindergartens these days, aren't they? I was nearly 20. We only had sort of Bournemouth Pier and a back seat of a cinema. But a little bit about that shot. It was hot studio, it was heavy. The camera cables were the size of a soup tin. If you think of a Heinz beans tin, that was the thickness. I couldn't find a bit of cable, but it was as thick as that. And before we leave that still, the starting handle above my hand, you turn that and the lenses on the front went around, so you get wide or close, and my hand's on the focus. So it's nothing automatic. Very, very sort of, everything was manual. And if we have a look at a typical studio, it's a bit misty, I'm afraid, but there's no health and safety, was there? But everything was cabled. Cameras were cabled, microphones were cabled, lighting was cabled. And they seem to cram everything into one corner. Actually, there's a weatherman, a political interviewer, a newsreader, and one lonely microphone that had to cover it. I don't know what the sound was like. So if you can imagine, a hot studio and very inflexible, but great fun. Now, I put that in not because... How about Strictly Come Dancing of the 50s? There you are. Now, I haven't put that in to have a quick... I'm not lecherous, of course I'm not. But basically, I put that in to explain that the only way they got close-ups in those days were those tanks to trundle in and get them. You know, in Strictly on Saturday, you see everything wide and beautiful. They've got all sorts of special effects. You know, on OBs, they've got drones. In those days, you physically had to move to get anything. And that's why I put that in. And so that was the memory of the very first day. Under 20, nervous, up from the sticks. I'd failed at the grammar school. I'd failed in the RAF. And can you imagine when a letter came from the BBC offering me £400 a year? That was really... And incidentally, I'm quite sorry for the present day. You know, I know we sort of knocked them, but it's a much more difficult... I wouldn't have got through the door today. I didn't have those qualifications. And nowadays, it's very different. And so I feel quite sorry for them in a way. My bicycle was just out of shot. I used to cycle down from Bayswater. And, of course, I was as nervous as hell. Do you know, when I went through the door, the first thing they did with me was give me a £3 a year soft sole shoe allowance, because the microphones were so sort of open, if you walked across the floor, you ruined the production. So I thought, God, £3 wasn't bad, was it? I got a pair for £150. And when I look at it, names still echo. Sort of, some of them you'll remember. Gilbert Harding was there, Joyce Grenfell, Fred Emney, Henry Hall. I bet you remember Gilbert Harding. Anyway, so those are the sort of memories it conjures up. And I've got, I'm very pleased, I've got the very first soap, actually, which it was the Grove family. I'm going to run it in a minute, but I did work on this. We had three cameras on it. One, when they broke down, you carried on. And one week, we carried on one camera. And you can imagine, we were sweating, because you're filling that half an hour, and one by one, things were going a bit wrong. But what an apprenticeship. I mean, we had no analysis. You couldn't play it back afterwards, but I learned more from that era than I did years later. It was the BBC at its best, really. And so often the hardship. So I'm going to play a bit now. I'll talk over it. But basically, as I say, three cameras. The microphone was slung up like you saw the other one. And so it gets very crowded in a minute. You'll see that's the only way they could hear. They got under the microphone. And spare a thought for these old actors. Once they got going, that was it. There was no fluffs and all. There's no turning back. It's a very special. Let's hear a bit of the sound.
Hello. Hello. I've just put my...
Please fade the sound up now if you like. If you want.
How are you, Jane? What a lovely dress.
Oh, thank you. All right, off we go then. Oh, hello, Jane.
Hello.
We better go in our body into Gran's room, say goodbye.
Oh, I don't know she's up yet.
Oh.
Gladys, I've had a sleepless night.
She's quite old and she fluffs in a minute, but...
Yes. Without me being there, this won't be a holiday for you. It'll only be more work. So I'm coming with you to look after you.
But
now listen, for 50 out of 52 weeks you work and toil for me. Whatever I ask for, you get it for me. But the other 2 weeks are mine to try and...
60 years old. This is a film recording,
so
obviously.
We're coming with you.
Because there's no videotape.
Work on the holiday.
Yeah, but where are you going to sleep, Gran?
Oh, Jones has got to...
Look how crowded it is.
But Granny can't sleep on a camp bed.
Gladys,
tell you where you could hear.
Made up.
I've argued with her for hours, but she seems determined. Besides, I don't see why she shouldn't be with you all on holiday.
All right, Gran, of course you can come. And I shall be delighted to paddle with you.
I shall not be a party with any disgusting habit of showing me ankles.
Oh, no, very nasty.
Off we go then. So there we are, the Grove family. Now, I've put that there because I've got 2 points to make about this photograph. Please, I thought, it's not this sort of audience, surely. Basically, there's a reason to put it up. It's not just to have a quick look at Arthur Askey, I'm sure, some Liverpool comedian, very popular in those days. He used Sabrina for nearly so many of his sketches. Now, I've put it in because you won't believe it. There was no page three of The Sun in those days. They had to put security on the studio door to keep the men out. They'd find any excuse to go in and have a look at Sabrina. And there was... I didn't try to get in, of course. And but as I say, security on the door to keep the men out. We were so naive. They sent me up to the festival hall. I was doing some stage managing. And I was only 20. And this very famous Oriental pianist said, "Mr. Roy, would you like to hold my hands?" And I thought, this is it. This is it. Working class man elopes with famous pianist, and the producer tapped me on this, "You silly bugger," you see, she always warms her hands before she plays the piano. Right, on we go. I can't just think about when I joined, for goodness sake. I mean, it'll be going some time then. I've put that in, it's got nothing to do with television. But that photograph is nearly 200 years old. It'll soon be 200 years old. I put it in just to show you that man's sort of aim was to see things, you know, his etchings on caves at one time, but he always wanted to see himself in the forms of photographs, and it was only a question of time when television, they want things to move, and, you know, and so in fact, in those sort of 20s sort of time, a man that played such an important part to the start of television. And he was incredible, John Logie Baird, really, because there was no television service. So why should you try? You know, we all sort of, you can imagine, if you've got a television service, you want to improve it and sort of be inventive. And that sort of a machine there, it got a headline because he managed to transmit a photograph from one corner of the room to the other. That's how primitive it was. He inspired it in colour. An incredible man, actually. And he had just had an ordinary job in Scottish industry. He was born to invent because he was so upset by gangrene in the World War II trenches. He designed some socks which reduced it enormously. That's the sort of person he was. It was the time of the first BBC Charter, of course, and Lord Reith. What an austere man. Do you remember? Television is to inform, to educate and entertain in that order. He wouldn't have stood much chance with Love Island, would he? God, dear. There's a silly story about him, actually. A security man was locking up the offices in Broadcasting House, and one of the doors was ajar, and he looked in, and a couple were on the desk making love. On the desk making love. So you know what security men are. He went back to his mates, said, "You should see what I've seen." It gets back to Lord Reith. He goes berserk. He says, "Call a meeting straight away of higher management." He said, "Right, we all know why we're here. We've got to sack that man." And somebody stood up and said, "You do realise he's related to the Foreign Secretary?" He said, "Well, sack the woman." And somebody stood up and said, "Do you realise she's got the best idea for radio since it started?" He said, "Well, burn the desk." Before leaving that still, it was prestige in those days, the radio. That's what it was all about. Television, it was weirdos like me, actually, just a few people playing around. But radio was the prestige. That's where your son went if he wants to get on. And as you can see, that was the first radio broadcast. And prestige, they all went in bowler hats. And those are sound effects which they had on the road. So I thought you'd like to see that. Right, now, as I go through these sort of milestones... this history, my history, the significant events, milestones, are royal events, Olympic Games, those big occasions, because it makes people sort of, they become more inventive, they get a bit more money, it stretches the system, and they play a very important part, actually. So the 37 coronation was the first such milestone. We'll just play a bit to you. See how the press reacts.
Our mystic magic rays is all out of space to bring a new wonder to you.
Edward was the first member of the royal family to be televised, his features used as the test card for the cameras.
Now, it was a very modest start, but a very important one. It got an audience around the London area of about 10,000. No cameras in the Abbey from the royals. No cameras in the Abbey. We don't want those ugly things in. So there's no cameras in the Abbey. There are few en route. It got an audience around London, about 10,000. But it was a start, and a very important start. Now, what I want to tell you is that it's just as well probably that it didn't get televised in the Abbey, because I'll read a report at the end of it. The Dean of Westminster fell down the steps and nearly broke the crown. He was saved by the cushion. And the Duke of Somerset compared the Dean of Westminster to a half-awake bat, bewildered and incompetent. So it's just as well there were no cameras in there. A little bit more about it. There's the happy photograph at the end of the service. Not a smile. They didn't smile in those days, did they? They weren't encouraged, actually. One rude bastard at the last talk I did said, "They look like they've come from one of your talks." That really gave me confidence. Dear, oh dear. Right, onward we go. Now, I just reflect on the war. What was significant was the number of Spitfire pilots and Bomber Command, these sort of people, that came out of the service, came back home, and became very successful producers and directors. There were six fighter command Spitfire pilots in my corridor at one stage of the BBC. And it's pretty obvious why. They'd just been shot up by the Luftwaffe. They'd lost their mates. And so coming into a television studio or an outside broadcast, it didn't worry them too much if a camera broke down, did it, what they'd been through. And it was very, very significant that how many made a success of television coming from that sort of background. And I've picked on one person in particular I work with. I did Match the Day for 3 years with Ken and the World Cup. He's remembered for, "They think it's all over." Oh, well done. Now, the reason why I've picked on him, for a number of reasons. First of all, I worked with him. Secondly, he was a pathfinder. He wasn't Bomber Command. And I'm sure some of you will know that that was a suicide mission. They flew in mosquitoes. They went ahead of the bombers. They were literally target practice for the gunfire from the ground to distract the Germans. And the bombers went in to hit their targets. Now, if you did three sorties, it was a miracle if you survived. Ken did 11, and he got back. And so when he was in the commentary box and when he was working with me, he was never sort of really flustered. He never talked about the war years, like they don't really, very few do. But he had enormous confidence after that sort of background. Now, I've got a silly item here. Before we leave the beautiful game, it's called, isn't it? I want you to hear the most over-the-top commentary there ever will be. Little Norway beat England. And the Norwegian commentator went berserk. And some of the names he uses, you won't believe it. Let's hear it.
Vi er best i verden. Vi har slått England. England, kjempers fødeland. Lord Nelson, Lord Beaverbrook, Sir Winston Churchill, Sir Anthony Eden, Clements Attlee, Henry Cooper, Lady Diana. Vi har slått dem alle sammen. Vi har slått dem alle sammen. Maggie Thatcher, can you hear me? Maggie Thatcher, your boys took a hell of a beating. Your boys took a hell of a beating.
Can you imagine having him on Match of the Day every Saturday? Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear. Right, one of the milestones. I told you, these are significant dates. The London Olympics, they were known as the Austere Games. They had not much money, it wasn't long after the war. And if they ran out of cables, they couldn't cover anything. So it's mostly around Wembley, I think Wembley Pool. But basically, if you didn't have a cable, you couldn't cover it. That's how austere it was. I worked on athletics a few years after that, and to show you how austere it was and how primitive it was, to actually get their records, for instance. They had six old fogies like me standing by at the finishing line, and as the 100 metres or the 400 metres went by, they all clicked their watches, all six of them, and then they compared the times, and that's how your records were done. But what a difference. Let's compare it now with, not that long ago, was it? The actual, the London Olympics. What a difference a few decades make. I'll read out the statistics to you. 20,000 journalists, 2,500 hours of TV, 40 cameras on the marathon, 33 3D cameras, 400 tons of Omega timing equipment, and a world audience of 5 billion. How it changed from the austere games. Now, this is the big one. I'm sure you all remember it. This is where television came of age. This an audience of 20 million. The cameras were welcomed in the Abbey, all six of them. They had about 20 en route, and so it's a very different day. So things that the Queen welcomed it. And you know, one of my ex-bosses at ITV, a guy called Tony Flanagan, he made his name because he was only about this high, came up to my elbow, and they shoved him in an alcove sort of stained glass window above the Queen. And I don't know what he did for spending the loo, by the way, because he was up there about 3 hours. And he took the close-ups of the Queen. He was the only one that could fit into the stained glass window. I've never told that story before. That's a bit of ad lib. How about it? Right, so basically 20 million, and incidentally, it wasn't 20 million sets. So I'm going to stand up so I can see you. Enormous cinema audience, and I'm sure some of you remember the curtains drawn. There was more than two or three in the front room, but that's a 20 million audience, the biggest milestone so far. This was television's day. It came of age. in that coronation, the Queen Salote of Tonga came, a very popular lady, great fun, always smiling. The public liked her. The royal family adored her. And the memory, really, of that occasion was as her carriage was going by the VIP box, one of the VIPs said, "My God," he said, "how nice to see Queen Salote over here again. But who's that little man in the carriage next to her?" Apparently Noel Coward said, "her lunch." Little story about, it's quite rude actually, but I'm sure we'll cope. I'm telling this story because, not because it's rude, but it shows that, you'll see my gaffe at the end of the programme, but you could be a good journalist like Michael Barrett, a presenter, respected and everything else, but if you make one bad mistake, you're remembered for that, regardless of your career. And on this particular night of an evening programme, the Tonight programme, I think it was, that they have, at the end of these sort of programmes, they're live, they have what is known as a buffer item. So you can actually cut it back. If the interviews run too long, then you, gardening or cookery or something like that. On this particular night, they had Fanny Craddock. Do you all remember her? Yeah. Well, her recipe that night was donuts. And they overran, and the director said, "Michael, get in there, wind her up, we're overrunning." So he goes in, and he says, "Thank you, Fanny." And he looks at the camera and says, "See you next week. And who knows, one day your donuts will look like Fanny's." Sorry. Right, a little bit about a big occasion. This was Telstar. I expect some of you remember Telstar. Now, I'm telling it to show you the two ends of it. Basically, it was the big, big satellite night, American money, and units all over the place in Europe, UK, and America, obviously. And I was sent down to the Lizard lifeboat station in Cornwall. The Americans wanted us to do a rescue. And so they wanted the lifeboat to come down the ramp, hit the water, and go out for a mock rescue. Well, that was fair enough now. You could go out with a mobile phone, couldn't you? But not then. We had to wait for the tide to go out. And there's an enormous rock on the beach. And still there, I'm sure. And we had to build, while the tide was out, we had to build that rostrum, clamp it around the rock. And that's me, I assure you, on the top of it. And so I was able to get this head-on shot of the boat coming down. Well, that was fair enough, but with about half an hour, 20 minutes to go, the camera started flashing. So you have a microphone, and I said, "You better do something, otherwise the Americans won't get any pictures." So the engineers came out in a rowing boat with valves, and they came up the ladder and put the valves in the camera, and it worked perfectly. So if you think of the two ends of it, you've got satellite, Kennedy doing his press conference, all the technology in the world at one end, and at the other end you've got a rowing boat with valves, which I thought was quite interesting. But in 1955, time for a song, it all changed, the coming of commercial television.
"Sorry, you just have to wait. I'm finishing me merriment. They're too good to hurry mint.
Merriments, merriments, too good to hurry mint. Why make haste when you can taste the hint of mint in merriment?
Merriments, merriments, too good to hurry mint.
Merriments, merriments, too good to hurry mint.
Delicious. Now to war.
Treat yourself to merriments, the too good to hurry mints. With a delicious hint of mint.
Merriments, merriments, too good to hurry mint."
So how things changed. I bet you all remember that, do you? Well, it was 55, and I was disloyal. I left the BBC, and I went over to ATV for £750 a year. I nearly doubled my salary. Very disloyal. But what an occasion. It wasn't just money. Can I just say, before I mention ITV, what an enormous credit up to those years from the BBC to produce the training of staff. As I said, the Lime Grove was an enormous apprenticeship for me. there's no way that this was a rescue job. It just brought a bit of competition in, and they also had control on the world's artists on the Palladium show. 20 million, for example, the only two artists in the world that didn't come to it was Elvis and Frank Sinatra. Everybody else came, an audience of 20 million. And instantly, Lou Grade and Val Parnell, my bosses, they became, I don't know how many times, billionaires. Their original investment in ITV was £2,000 each. £2,000. So it was a very different world. And incidentally, the Palladium, it introduced us to one of the great men of television, light entertainment.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for Beat the Clock. And we have a return couple this week from last week. Is that right,
yes.
Angela?
Yes. Mr. and Mrs. Northfield from Cambridge.
That's right. And it's Sophie and
Bill.
And Bill. Sophie and Bill. You had a good week?
Yes,
I bet everybody's been talking to you and giving you advice and all that sort of thing. Well, we'll give you our first game because you didn't do anything.
There we are. They don't come much greater, do they? I mean, you either liked him or you didn't, I suppose, but most people did. We knew from the first few days that he was going to be around a very long time. He had this instinct for if he came here, he would know just the person to home in on. And that friendly abuse, of course, he was full of catchphrases. In this era, wasn't it? I'm in charge. But there's no way he was. It was just destined to be very successful, and I'm sure some of you miss him. There's a scandal with Beat the Clock. It never got to the press, but we all got memos in those days, not emails, and it said, on no account will friends and relatives of the staff appear on Beat the Clock as contestants. Somehow the admin all got cocked up, and the scene shifters and the painters at the Palladium were getting their friends and relatives on us. And you know, have a word with Uncle George down the road, he'll get you on the Palladium. You put on a new suit, 20 million audience, you'll go home with loads of prizes. It was an awful scandal, and somehow it never got to the press, actually. Right, Winston's funeral. Now, the memories I have of Winston's funeral is that he took a very long time to die, actually. I don't know if you remember the sort of days leading up to it. But we moved a unit into 10 Downing Street, thinking we'd be there for a couple of days. It was there for nearly 2 weeks. So 10 Downing Street was my place of work. I used to go to Whitehall and get my ham sandwiches during the break. And why I mention these memories is that I hardly gave a pass to the Bobby on the door. He just had a quick look at it. Nowadays, it's a wrought iron gates, machine guns. How the world has changed, actually. But it was a very incredible experience. Mr. May, the clerk of the works, showed me around the staircase where Ernest Bevan used to have to stop because of his asthma, the chopping blocks in the basement where the beef from the Argentine used to come in from Winston. It was an incredible 2 weeks for me. That was my place of work. And I was sent over at the time to interview. I had to go to the lying in state, and we were interviewing Lord Ramsay, the Archbishop with the bushy eyebrows, if you remember him. And I remember it because with about 10 minutes to go, the director said, "Roy, get in there. His crucifix is banging against the microphone. Get in there." So I go in. I said, "I'm so sorry, sir, but I've got to separate your crucifix from the microphone." And he said, "The Archbishop," he said, "but my boy, what happens if my tummy rumbles?" I put this in. It was roughly the same sort of time, just to reflect on one or two people in it. I'm sorry the camera really was more round to the right, because that's Monty, Lord Montgomery. It was a programme about linking him up with Eisenhower in America via satellite. And I was so proud of Monty, because with his stopwatch, he was always at rehearsals on time, and Eisenhower was always late. And before we leave it, the man with the pipe, that's the father of David and Jonathan Dimbleby, Richard Dimbleby. Look at that awful haircut in the background. It's even worse than what I've got this morning, isn't it? So that was the Cabinet War Rooms, as you can see. I put this in because the paparazzi is all part of the history of television. And what was significant about this was that it was the time of the Bay of Pigs, and the White House didn't want any sort of publicity, no photographs, because Kennedy was actually getting the advice from Eisenhower. They're walking in the garden. And this photographer, the great wall of security men, he shoved his camera through the legs of one of the security men and took that picture. And he got a world exclusive. It shows you the legs they'll go to get their pictures. I went to Pakistan for a couple of years with the Overseas Development, which I really enjoyed, actually, television in the desert. And I had enormous respect for their engineers. Not much money, but they were first class, actually, and produced a very good service with videotape exchange and everything else. So I was there as a program advisor, but the editorial side was a bit strange at times. In the first few weeks, they sent me up to Lahore. It was the horse and cattle show, enormous, three times the size of Wembley Stadium. And you're advising on everything, you know, and the commentary box, I went up there, and this commentator, he had this lovely Oxford accent, but he couldn't say horse. It came out as arse. So I thought, I've got to be tactful here, you know, in these sort of countries. So I said, Shockett, I said, that's a very good research commentary. I said, but could I suggest you say horse and not arse? Oh, Norton Saab, this is the advice we need. Thank you so much for telling me. So I go down in the arena and I start hear the commentary again. And he said, if you look to the left, you see the Arabian arses. You look to the right, you see the Indian arses. And any minute, the whole arena will be full of arses. So I gave up then. I gave up, actually. And I went up to the editor one day. They ran the weather for 4 minutes. And I said, why do you run it so long? I said, we haven't had a cloud for 9 months. It's been blue skies in the desert. Oh, Norton Saab, Norton Saab. Unlike you, we always get it right, he says. I gave up there. Right, now, do any of you have any problems with the accents? So it's Liverpudlian or Glaswegian. On television, I'm sure you do. I do, anyway. So television seems to make it that much worse, trying to understand people. Now, you won't believe this interview. And hand up if anybody knows what he's talking about.
Band people are employed in the factory.
Well, not very many, as far as I know, anyway.
Well, there are upwards of 1,000 people altogether.
My wife is employed, but I'm not employed. And there's a council beside this town hall. It doesn't give...
You're moving around, yes. You see, in the camera.
We've got a council on the band.
Wait a minute. Now, keep your voice down, yes. Because the microphone will take it.
Yes.
Just as you're talking to me now.
It's fine. We've got a council on the band.
Shout because you're blasting the microphone.
Right.
You see,
yes.
The microphone can get you all right.
We've got a curse on Mr. Band that doesn't give work to the people who's born in the town. They don't give
it. Can you believe it? Anybody knows what he's talking about? I don't think so. Now, I couldn't spend 50 minutes with you without talking about the great man. You know, we use treasures and legends, and I think David Attenborough is just above that. And I think it's better I let the man talk for himself.
There's been a huge shift in the way that people think about the natural world. It's an odd thing that over the last 50, 60 years of when television began, human beings have become, I mean, to start with, the population has tripled, but also they tended to live in towns and become more and more cut off from the natural world in the way that my grandfather or great-grandfather would know all the things about the British countryside. I don't. On the other hand, television has enabled people to see aspects of the world that my great-grandfather didn't even know exist. I've had a privileged time. I mean, to be able to just think of something in the abstract and say, oh, that must be very interesting to see it, and play your cards right, and you go and see it.
So there we are. Just a few points. First of all, I never worked with him. It's a very specialist unit in Bristol. He works for Sky now and everybody because... they need money. But did you hear in that interview, the world's population have tripled since he's been making programs. When will we ever learn? He was once asked, have you been everywhere? You seem to have been everywhere. He said, I've never been to Patagonia, he said, because you have to travel 1,500 miles to see an animal. And before I finish with David, I used to tell the students this, that life isn't just ambition. Because David was due to become Director General, and there's no bigger job. He was Director of Programs, and it was his job if he wanted it. And he said, hold on a minute. He said, I think I'll go back to my cameras and my animals. And thank God for us he did. The next milestone. I was fortunate to work on it. I had cameras down Whitehall and cameras over Waterloo Bridge. And if you think about it, it's just like covering the home straight at Newbury Races. But it's not quite like that. The hype, the colour, the noise. I mean, there were 600,000 people lined in the streets of London. and an audience of 750 million or billion. So when you're pressing the buttons on a thing like that, it feels very different. They sent me to Althorp House the night before. That's where, I don't know if any of you have been there, but that's where Diana spent a lot of her childhood. It's a simple item. It consisted of Lord Spencer, her brother, coming out of the house, getting a taper, lighting a beacon. I thought it was going to be a bonfire, but it's quite a solid structure. He lit the beacon, and then he was going to turn with champagne, and all the royal family watching in London, and he was going to say, good luck, Diana, tomorrow we'll all be thinking of you, something like that. Now, that sounds quite simple. It was only Dorian Williams was doing the commentary for me. Only a five-minute item. But luckily, I spoke to somebody from the estates with a leather apron. I said, oh, it's really sad. I said, this will be a pile of ash early because of our programme. Pile of ash, he said. You must be bloody joking. He said, it'll take 2 hours to get a glimmer. I'm only on the air for 5 minutes. I'm going to lose my job. I motored down to Buckingham. I got 20 gallons of paraffin. Came back like Fangio. The statesman and I doused it with 20 gallons of paraffin, and it went up like a bloody rocket. That's the only picture of it. It nearly took his sandals off. But, you know, we laugh now, but if anybody had been injured, I'd have been in the tower. But it shows you what lengths you go because of your program. And underneath it all, you know, as I say, one injury, if he got burned, I wouldn't be here tonight. It might have helped you. He only moved forward to get that glass from here to the front row. And in that time, it's nearly finished. It was, and London went mad. They said, oh, how wonderful. I thought, if only they knew. I can't do this day without talking about Harry Secombe. And I hope I don't go over the top with it, but I've never worked with a nicer, more decent human being. He was just, there were no flaws at all, actually. He called me the Galloping Major because I was always in a hurry. But he, and what talent. Writer, actor, opera singer, the Goons. Incredible man, actually. He's also such a nice man. He used to give the crew £20 at the end of the day to get a sandwich or something. I remember one true story. It's not funny, but it shows him for what he is. We're doing the Salisbury Highway, and no cameras around, and he walked through the entrance to the Salisbury Close, and there are almshouses on the left with where the clergy widows live. And they all got out, obviously, because they all want to see Harry walk by. And one of the widows said, Sir Harry, the Lord gave you a beautiful voice. And he took his hat off and said, and madam, one day I'll have to give it back. I always remember him for that. It didn't always go right. He invited his mate down. They're godfathers to each other's children. And it was in Wimborne, the highway at Wimborne. Everything was going so right. This shows you how things can turn for a director. Blue skies, Minster bells ringing, and Roy and Harry in a coach and carriage, a horse and carriage, approach road, coming into Wimborne, into the square, and the horses ploughed into the crowd. There was one broken leg. There were so many injuries. There was Harry and Roy with their sleeves rolled up, helping the injured. It was like the bloody Crimea. And I was crying on the pavement. I couldn't believe. I was known as Kiss of Death. Luckily, the leg got better, but it was a day that I wanted to forget, and thank God there were very few of them. My time in jail. Well, a few interesting points about it. First of all, when you go in and the doors clank behind you, it's amazing in such a short time how you take it all in your stride. If you like talk, well, not quite like talking to you, but basically, you know, you could be supermarket. Basically, you had to get a job done. And you didn't think about, I mean, these weren't doing shoplifting. They were all murdered. They were lifers, actually. And we were doing this gardening program. They had a little greenhouse and a 12-by-9 plot. Debbie Throw was doing the interview. And the head gardener we interviewed, he'd murdered 20 years before. They let him out on parole, and he murdered in the first week. So he's there for the rest of his days. But he was an incredible gardener. And we did this interview with him. As I say, blue eyes, he was They don't look like murders. But basically, at the end of it, it ran about 12, 15 minutes, and I've only got a half-hour programme, so I've got to edit it. So I went in and saw him. We were given strange names, not the real names. And I said, that's a fabulous interview. I said, the gardeners will like it. It's full of information. I said, but I've got to edit it. I said, so if I could have you doing some watering or seed boxes or hoeing, if you could do some work for me, give me a chance to edit it. And this is a murderer, a serial murderer. He said, all right, mate. He said, I'll do a bit of deadheading. It's a true story. It's not a joke. It's a true story. And so, and as I was leaving, they had a six-a-side football team that came out. They had the goalposts against the 15-foot wall. And they were sponsored by Chubb Locks. I thought, oh, I'd get that. Quite a day to remember. Right, I thought I'd do a bit of as I'm talking to a university sort of audience, a university of the third age, I must do a bit of technology. So basically, these things have been around a long time, but I thought we'd just have a recap on them, a reflect on them. Green screen has transformed studio work. I can only explain it in simple terms, but basically they found out, it was blue, but it went to green, that you could key, with the right lighting, you could key the vision onto a green surface. An oak desk, you could headline, Niagara Falls, you can put vision onto a green surface. And of course it saves a lot of time, and it's ideal for documentaries and sport and news. You wouldn't put Judi Dench on a Victorian play surrounded by green. That would go too far. But it was cost-effective, saved time. You made sure your presenter wasn't dressed in green, obviously. And I thought I'll play a green screen actually working now. I think you'd be quite interested in it. And you'll see. Now, at home, they're not seeing that green. They're seeing that camera. Isn't that an amazing camera? See, that's what they're seeing. That's keyed onto the green surface. That camera is a bit different to Lime Grove, isn't it? And he's looking at a map. They're not seeing the green. That's what they're seeing at home. And he looks at a monitor. He glances at it. And that's how he sees what he's pointing at. So I thought you'd be interested in that. I thought, you know, I'm sure quite a few are interested in tennis. I thought you'd like to know how slow-mos are done at tennis.
So my name is Luke Aggas. I'm the Director of Operations for Hawkeye Innovations. So my main job is to look after the 10 cameras to make sure that they're tracking accurately and reliably. We've got a big team here of about 14 people across three courts this year. Here up in the Laver review booth, we watch every single ball tracked and track that via our cameras that are positioned all the way around the back of the stadium. You have five cameras at each end, and they're triangulated to give you the 3D location of that particular ball. Any ball that's close, we're already analysing before the player's challenged or the chair umpire has announced the challenge. When the chair umpire has announced that the ball will be contended, then we look at all the information, and within about 5 to 10 seconds, just as the crowd look up to the video boards, the challenge will be displayed. So we can see in the video board, the ball was called out.
There we are. 10 cameras, 14 staff, just to get your slow-mos. So, now this next item, it's going to give me a rest. A television director is going to take you down the Thames on the Henley Regatta, and you'll see that everything's under his control. If the director goes to a camera, you go to it. He's interested, the sound coming up, every aspect. And it's the most frequent question is, what's the difference between a producer and a director? Well, a producer, in fact, is the overall editorial side, the script, the casting, the legal side, and he has a director working under him. But they're very much together. It's not that sort of separation. I was a producer-director. I didn't reach the Disney Heights. Now, when you go down the river, as I say, you're going to see cameras all over the place. On the riverbank, you'll see the control rooms. And at the end, you're going to see drones, because this is the main reason I put this on. You'll see drones working, so watch out for the drones at the end.
Yes, A for titles. A for titles, stand by in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, roll A. Off you go, one. Stand by then for the graphics. Stand by, here they go. And off they go. Follow it on one, stand by three. Love having a Cineflex. It just gives me so much options to do stuff.
This is control room. It.
Very nice, Matt.
Cameras everywhere.
Just spin round on three then. That's really nice. Stand by three. That's really good. as they cross. Thank you, and that'll really work well. Thank you.
So watch out for the drones.
Widen, widen.
Watch out for the drones. There we are. The drone's going up.
Okay, on you, drone. Leave the shot. Go top, go through, look down on a two-shot, and then look up towards Henley. Just hold that shot on the drone and take a shot at the cocks. Hold it back on four.
So there, that's really the thing of the future. And it's controlled by a drone pilot, as you can see there. Her left hand is on a control where it can go up, can tilt it, move on, go to a different location. Very responsible job. She's called a drone pilot. And you'll see the sort of setups that they actually get involved with. That's the drone, and a cycle event. It could keep steady in 30-mile-an-hour winds. And it's transforming some aspects of television. A friend of mine's lost his job on cricket because he used to go around the world producing the high tower shots on cricket and things like that. And they've now done away with it and they've put a drone there. So you'll see it more and more. They obviously worry about the regulations and airports and things, but it's here to stay. And of course we've got cameras on Mars. I thought I'd throw that at the end. So we've come from Lime Grove to Mars. We've come a long way, haven't we? I thought you'd be interested in a little bit about the assassination of bin Laden. On the left you see the Oval Office, the president there, Obama, and Hillary, and all the military advisors. And 200 miles from Islamabad is bin Laden himself. So basically what happens, in fact, the president is given the orders to go in, and I'll play you a raid now, and watch out for the cameras on the helmets. This is what it's all about. And I'll freeze the first one. They are on the top of that helmet, there's a camera. And when I run it, you'll see they've all got cameras on their helmets.
Go.
So there we are. Amazing, isn't it? So what in fact has happened there is that they've all got powerful transmitters, these cameras on the helmets. There's a hovering aircraft. An engineer type actually feeds it back through repeater stations and satellites straight into the Oval Office. Quite frightening, I think. You know, we talk about armchair warfare. It's here. I'm not sure what the reception was like. I think it broke at one stage. Those men, they could lose their lives. I'm not exactly worrying about composition, are they, the camera, but it's obviously fixed up. It's the future, I'm afraid. I thought just show you a few things in my scrapbook. Peter O'Sullivan, a few interesting races. Basically, those binoculars came from a German U-boat in the Second World War. Actually managed to get that. And to show you the league they're in, his first horse, Be Friendly, won at 10-1. He had £1,000 on it. And his commentary didn't waver. And you suddenly realise that his bank balance is different to mine, actually. I put that in, just it was the first Prime Minister, really, that got to grips with television. I think most people realise that he won the 64 election mainly because of television. He was ahead of everybody. But he always had that awful pipe. That's me on my knees, by the way. Great Ormond Street, we used to volunteer for that. We enjoyed it so much. We got so much out of it. We missed our lunch. It was all live, but we got something out of being with those children on Christmas morning. And there was virtually a waiting list to actually go on it. And that's the young Leslie Crowther who presented it. Spike, I worked with him. I'm sure you all have your own views on Spike. He's a good man. The World War II obviously affected him badly. He wrote beautiful children's books. There's nothing wrong about Spike. It's just he was very often misunderstood. He rang me up one morning. He was very interested in his future wife, who was a BBC secretary. It's Monday morning, he said, "Roy, are you on your own?" I said, "Spike, it's Monday morning, my wife's in the room. Has she got a 41.5-inch inside leg?" I said, "Spike, you're right to within a quarter of an inch." He says, "I accuse you of the murder of Mahatma Gandhi." John Arlott, the voice of cricket, great Hampshire man. He was an incredible person, actually. He wrote hymns. God's Farmers All Creation, that was John's. Wrote beautifully. Left school at 15, but ended up as a very respected figure. He liked his claret. He wouldn't trust any wine on the road. He had to take his own claret. And his briefcase was known as his travelling cellar. Alec Rose, I think he really was a very popular figure, actually. I know he was second to Francis Chichester, but I was very lucky. I was producing the Southampton Boat Show, and I got him down as a main guest. And we showed him around the show, and he saw all the technology, the computerized navigation, the computerized radar, all these toys. And we thought it would be quite significant how he'd react to it. And we put him on the pontoon and interviewed him. We said, right, Alec, you've seen all those things, all that technology. How would it change you if you really were starting again to go around the world on your own? He said, my priority would always be to choose a good, strong hull. And finally, I just thought I'd put that in. That was my lucky day. You can either get people on your show in minutes, or it takes weeks, or you never get them. And with a few phone calls and going down to the Palladium, I managed to get Ginger Rogers on the show from Birmingham. Sorry about the focus, that was my fault. Incredible lady. She was 68 then. Her dance routines, her feet were going as high as her head. She played tennis twice a week. And when she got up and danced with my presenter at the end of the programme, I couldn't believe my luck, actually. And incidentally, in the background, which you can hardly see, is the late James Hunt playing the trumpet with the Kenny Ball Band. So it's a still I treasure, actually. Now, this is the mistake I made, I'm afraid. I'm not sure. I wasn't going to tell you, but I will, actually. It travelled. I had it forever. And so I'll read out what this newspaper says. On the presentation evening in Troika, Portugal, Roy Norton, director of the TVS programme about the competition, dropped the sought-after award, which broke into several pieces. It was the most beautiful cut-glass trophy, and there were hundreds of anglers who'd fished for it. It was like winning the FA Cup, as far as they're concerned. Beautiful cut glass. And I didn't quite drop it, but I think I nudged it. And it fell onto a slate floor. So we had bits of glass, and an Andover window cleaner won it. And he was actually crying, actually. We presented the glass bits to him in a carrier bag. And I can't tell you how. I still get paid thinking about it. It's awful. So that's why I couldn't tell you at the start. Now, look, we're nearly at the finish now. But I just want to, you may think it's obvious, but I need to make this point. We talked about green screen, drones, incredible cameras, satellites. And if we think about it, without the ideas people, the playwrights, the people that devise formats, they're not worth anything, are they? So it still comes down in so many businesses to that, the written word, the scripts that make us laugh. I've got four very short clips now. The first two, you've seen them so many times, they still make you smile, but this time, analyse them for yourselves. Simplicity, one camera sort of technique, but they still make you smile, you've seen them 20 times. But I'm showing them for that reason, to show you how simple, but fantastic ideas. It's the ideas people that sort of make them.
All right, Granddad, we're ready. You can start undoing it now.
He's coming, girl boy. One more turn, Dale.
All right. Now brace yourself, Rodney. Brace yourself.
One camera.
On a winner here, three. All right, play it nice and cool, son. Nice and cool, you know what I mean?
It was great, wasn't it?
Drink up, we're leaving.
Aren't you going to try for them birds?
No, you're cramping my style, mate. You're cramping my style.
Right, these next two, great ideas, but a bit of technology. The first one uses green screen, and the last one uses amazing sound technology. And you'll see the Queen as you've never seen her before.
Here she is, going in there. They all come out to greet her. Okay.
Now they present her with a Guinness. Okay. 2 hours later. Look at this.
Well, I hope you enjoyed it. Safe journey home.
Thank you very, very much. It was a wonderful, wonderful morning. Thank you.